Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. I have with me Andy Green from Rolling Stone.
What's up, Andy? Brian. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty well.
Good.
So today's going to be sort of a special flashback episode of Rolling Stone Music Now. Bob Dylan, as you may have heard, has a new album out. It's called Triplicate. It's another sort of standards album where he sings, actually, in my opinion, quite well, some of the Great American Songbook standards. And some people might call this a weird direction that he's been in. I wouldn't call it that, but I understand why people would call that. So we thought we'd look back at another sort of divergent moment from Bob Dylan. Really interesting album, 1985, Empire Burlesque. And to talk about this album, we have Arthur Baker, who worked extensively on it, the legendary Arthur Baker of Planet Rock and many other things. Arthur, are you there?
Yeah, man, right here.
Welcome. How you doing?
Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely.
Any time I can talk about Dylan, you know.
Yeah, it's you've done a lot of stuff, but this is a certainly an interesting moment in your career. So to give the audience some backstory, before you came in, Dylan had been recording, going back to 84. With various lineups. There were a lot of heartbreakers involved. There were a lot of members of the Heartbreakers.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of heartbreakers. He had just sort of, I guess he had worked with Knopfler before. I actually have a great Knopfler story because he actually showed up at the studio one night and it was pretty funny. But yeah, so he had a bunch of songs and I got a call from my friend Joe McEwen, who you guys may know. He was working at Columbia at the time. Mm. And he said, oh, and I had done some Bruce Springsteen remixes. And he had said, oh, you want to meet Dylan? And I was like, you know, literally very nervous because I had been a big Dylan fan. And high school, I had written my graduate paper on Dylan. I mean, it was just like of my age, everyone was sort of fan of Dylan, I guess, growing up. But, you know, I went over to the hotel, and the first thing was he literally hadn't had room service there. Well, he had room service. He ate a lot in his room, but they never picked up any of the dishes.
So no maid service, I guess, yeah.
No maid service. But there were probably four or five trays of food and, you know, lots of leftovers and stuff. And he had a pile of cassettes, and he just started playing me songs and, you know, literally probably fired about 15 or 20. And he was like, well, what would you do? I said, well, I probably listened to him a few more times before I, you know, and you know, we hung out and I got the gig. So it went from there. But I mean, he had tons of songs and just really amazing. You know, they were great songs, and there was some that needed work and some that didn't. But you know, it was sort of patch up gig. There were most of the things were actually recorded. We went in and we cut a few from scratch, but basically it was for the most part a remix thing. We cut a few songs from scratch, but for the most part it was like trying to finish up a bunch of stuff.
Was it your impression that it was his idea to talk to you, or that his label was like, let's get the cool guy, let's get Arthur Baker and make Dylan modern, and he kind of went along with it?
It definitely wasn't his idea. You know, there's no way it was his idea. So literally, because it was Joe, and Joe was very well thought of over there. He had been a journalist, which they didn't hold that against him. So, you know, but he was, you know. So basically, and I had done the Springsteen stuff. So maybe I'm sure they sold him on that. If they were going to sell him on anything, there was nothing else I would have had done that he would have related to at all. So
right.
I don't know. I guess when we met, you know, he was able. You know, we were able to get a little vibe going, and you know, and it worked out. I mean, as I said, it wasn't like I, because you would assume, because I was making like hip hop, well, rap records and stuff, that I didn't know his work, but I was fully aware of everything he had done. So I was a fan. So basically, you know, I didn't really want to go, you know, I didn't want to make an electro track. I mean, you know, it was sort of, I wanted to just finish stuff up and maybe polish it a bit, and that was it. You know, some of the things work and some of the things going back didn't work, but they were great songs on that album. I think the fact that three of the songs were covered and did well, like, but with other artists within a year or two of the album. I mean, Emotionally Yours, the OJs redid, and it was like a top five R&B record. And When the Knife Comes Falling from the Sky, Jeff Healey covered. And then I covered with Grace and You for the Fried Green Tomatoes soundtrack, I'll Remember You, which Bob loved the new version. He called me up and said, I love what you did, because I put sort of a new chorus at the end, like a new refrain on the end, and he loved that. So, I mean, there were great songs on the album. I think really had a lot of really good songs.
So what was the first step once you got the gig? Like, how did it go from there?
Well, we were working at Power Station, and the first stuff we did actually was working on a new track, which was When the Night Comes Falling from the Sky.
Yeah.
And he had the East Street Band. He had, like...
Van Zandt and...
He had Steve in there, and he had Max, and he had the piano.
Roy Bittan, yeah.
Player. Yeah. So basically, that's the first night I was in, and he cut it, and then he was like concerned that it sounded too much like Springsteen. Well, I said, well, using his band, wasn't that the idea? And so he sort of canned that version, and then we went back in with Sly and Robbie.
Well, let's play the E Street Band version for a minute and hear that, or the, you know, it's really the partial E Street Band, but we'll hear that.
You can look out across the fields, see me returning. Smoke is in your eyes, you draw a smile.
And now we've heard that. Let's hear the Sly and Robbie version.
Yeah. Okay.
That Arthur did.
Look out across the fields, see me returning.
So obviously, it changed a great deal. In fact, the release version, one of the things that strikes me is it seemed to me that he was partially recreating a version of one of his songs that he's always been fascinated with, which is All Along the Watchtower, the Hendrix version. It has a very similar intro.
Yeah.
Was that referenced in the process?
No. I mean, yeah, I felt that, but it wasn't like we went back and listened to any of his old tracks. He didn't, you know, that, I mean, literally, he just goes for it in the studio. It's just, you know, maybe, yeah, I probably referenced that in finishing it. Obviously, you know, that was in my mind. But, yeah, you know, it was a pretty open situation, because Bob doesn't like to spend a lot of time in the studio, you know, so it's sort of... he would come in at 7 and leave at 9, and then I'd be there, and we'd be like, okay, now what do we do?
You so you're know? Talking about so 7, it's a 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. work day, is
yeah,
what you're saying.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Part of that time, he'd always have food. He'd get the food from Sylvia's, you know, from the soul food place.
Huh.
Because that's when he was going out with the background singer, one of the background singers who he ended up marrying.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was sort of that vibe. We were had a big feed, and then everyone was really tired. So, you know, basically it was interesting. And you know, people would pop in. I mean, there are a lot of people would pop in on those sessions. And, you know, I mean, there were a lot. I mean, Bob wasn't really big on the technology side of it. So literally he would want to go in and sing with the background singers on the same mic for the vibe.
Right.
But then when we get a take and he'd want to change something, it would be like, well, you know, the background singers are on the same track. So when you do your punch in, we're going to have to punch in the background singers also. So
which is nearly, you know, that's almost impossible, right? Because they have to be in the exact same position.
No, we worked it out somehow we did. But you know, Bob, the other thing was Bob loved to rewrite lyrics, because Bob was mostly concerned about his lyrics more than anything else. So that, you know, he would do rewrites and all that, because, you know, he is Bob Dylan. People are going to be looking at those lyrics forever. So it was a great, you know, it was a great process. I mean, there were definitely a lot of moments I'll never forget. And it, you know, it was a great experience. And, you know, I mean, the idea that he's now doing a lot of these cover albums of classic American songs. It's funny, because when we were remixing we mixed the album at Right Track, and one day the music's pretty loud, and he's sort of sitting in front of the board and on a couch, and I'm hearing something. I'm like, what the fuck? Where's that? And we turn the level, and it's him playing Like a Virgin. You know? he's like, Bob, what's up, man? He's like, man, can't we do a record like Madonna, Prince? You know, but hey, he could do a cover version album of, you know, 80s classics. He probably, maybe that will be the next thing.
That could
he does.
Be next.
I don't know. But you never know with Bob.
To return to When the Night, one of the things that's striking, especially since that's, you know, a song that you did, you know, actually with him, the drum sound on that. Yeah. Was he playing an artificial kit, an electronic kit, or what was going, like, how did that sound?
Yeah, that was Sly Dunbar. He was actually using Syndromes.
And whose idea was that?
That's what he played, and that's, and you know, no, Sly and Robbie had played with Bob before.
On Infidels, yeah.
Yeah, so they, you know, it wasn't literally... It was one of those things. Sly had his drums set up at Power Station, and he's using Syndromes, and I'm like, wow, that's sort of weird, because, you know, this is such a great drum sound here. But that's what Bob, you know, Bob liked it, and, you know, that's what Sly had. It was one of those things, you know, I came in, and they were already there, and I had met them earlier. I already knew the guys, and Sly was really into technology, so... But the very funny thing is, he had these toms set up, which he didn't really use, and he would just have the newspaper on those. So he'd be reading the newspaper while he'd be doing takes, literally. like someone else would be reading a music chart, but, you know, he was reading the newspaper, like Daily News or Post or something. So it was pretty bizarre. Huh. And, you know, that was the sound, but literally that wasn't anything that I brought to. I didn't go, oh yeah, let's use Syndromes. It was more like, that's what he had and that's what we used. It was sort of that kind of thing where, you know, and obviously the other songs on the record didn't use those, because they were cut with, I think the guy from
The Heartbreakers, and yeah.
Benetent and stuff, and those guys played on it. So Tom Petty's band.
It's funny.
So,
this is
it was a lot. But sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, I think a lot of people naively listening to it, any kind of like quote unquote 80s sounds, I think they would assume, oh, that must be Arthur. But I get that really isn't the case for a lot of things, right?
Well, yeah, no, I was trying, you know, I mean, we did do Glockenspiel and stuff. You know, I was always into Glockenspiel, like a Phil Spector thing. You know, I mean, listen, going back, you know, I would change a few things on it. But, you know, I really wanted him to, you know, at one point I was like, we should just go back and strip it all down. And, you know, basically that the one thing that we, you know, a lot of the songs have a stripped down feel, but obviously Dark Eyes, which was the last track we did on the record, you probably read his book, and basically he made a big thing out of that track, which I never knew while we were working on it. You know, we were about to finish the record. I said to him, you know, Bob, you've got all these songs. Why don't you pick one, and we'll just cut it live, and we'll just, you know, it'll be like a live recording, and maybe we'll put a little reverb on it or whatever, but let's try to do something live for the last track.
And acoustic, right? You wanted like an old school solo acoustic Dylan song. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just said, let's do it like you did with the harmonica and the acoustic guitar, and just cut it like that. And literally, so he came back in and he did this song Dark Eyes, and I think that's like the second take, and it was like,
wow,
man, that's unbelievable song. And then I didn't know until when his book came out, because he did he actually wrote the song that I said to him, why don't we do a song that's acoustic and blah blah blah. And he wrote the song that night and then recorded it. So literally, and he said that's the only time in his career up until that point that he ever sort of wrote a song at the request of the producer. Like, he usually would just use songs he had, but he thought that what I was saying was correct, so he thought, okay, I'll write a new song.
I mean, that's pretty cool. I mean, that's the ultimate production. You brought that song into life from nowhere. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah.
Which I didn't know. Listen, which literally I didn't know for 20 years, because I didn't know until he wrote the book, and I'm reading the book like a fan, and, you know, I mean, he has so many things he could talk about in his first book, and I was like totally, you know, floored when he mentioned that as being something really special. So I was sort of happy with that.
Yeah, and that's basically the last time in his whole career on an album that he sings solo acoustic on a non-cover on his own song. It's a pretty remarkable moment.
I would guess, and I think he should do it more often.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that, Arthur. So you're listening to Rolling Stone Music Now. We're talking about the 1985 Bob Dylan album, Empire Burlesque, with his producer, Arthur Baker. And we'll be right back with a lot more.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
Arthur, there's a story you tell that Bob was not super patient with the mixing of a modern multi-track album. So, and then at one point he sort of went off and did something. What happened that night?
Yeah, we were at Right Track, and basically he was telling me how Blonde on Blonde they mixed in like 2 days. I was like, yeah, okay, well, yeah, I was like, wow, great album, 2 days, you know, it was 4-track. So I try to sort of explain to him, which I knew he understood, but, you know, he always loved to, like, mess with you. And I'm saying, you know, we're on, like, 48-track, and that was 4-track, so you've got to give us, like, a lot more time because we have to go through the sounds, whatever. So he said, he decided to go to the movies, you know. So he came back and he had seen the movie was Cher.
Mask, right?
What's the name?
Mask.
Mask, yeah, he had seen Mask, and he was really like, he went, yeah, man, God, Cher was unbelievable. You know, I didn't know they made movies like that anymore. You know, I didn't think they ever made movies like that. He was so blown away by that movie. And then he came in and started listening and, you know, whatever. But it was like, I always remember him talking, you know, coming back. So, because obviously he knew Cher, and he just couldn't believe how good she was. And, you know, I mean, you know, he's definitely a fan of pop culture. You know, when he hooks into something, he really sort of is a fan of it.
Do you think that Dylan's goal was to get a big pop hit? Do you think that he wanted a, like, radio hit? He thought Tight Connection would possibly, like, really work on pop radio. Do you think that was the goal here?
You know what? It's hard to say. Because, I mean, then he did these really totally bizarre videos with Dave Stewart, you know?
Yeah, where he danced.
Those videos were a lot weirder than the record, for sure. Just bizarre, you know? They were very Miami Vice videos, so... I don't know. It's hard to say. Obviously, he did have huge pop hits earlier in his career when he, you know, he had huge pop hits. So I don't know. To get into his head, it really you know, it wasn't anything we talked about, except when he did say, the only thing I could say is that thing, oh, can't we make a record like Madonna or Prince? Now,
yeah.
I assumed he was joking. I'd say 95% of the thing was a joke, but maybe in the back of his mind, he wanted a hit. I don't know. It's really hard to say, because, you know, basically, a lot of the songs on the record were very catchy and commercial. Like I said, Emotionally Yours was an amazing song, and as was I'll Remember You. I think those two stand up, and they're very soulful. And as I said, the OJs, I think it was like the OJs version, I think was a top five record in R&B. It was a big hit.
Yeah, let's hear Bob's version. Sorry. Let's hear Bob's version of Emotionally Yours.
Come, baby, find me. Come, baby, remind me of where I once began.
And now let's hear the OJs version, which is great too.
Come.
Arthur, there's a cool thing on Bob's version of Emotional Yours. I think that's a track where there's like almost a Bob O'Reilly type synth comes in, like a little. Did you remember that?
Yeah,
bit?
Yeah.
How did that end up in there?
Sure, yeah. I put it in there. I tried things, and he, you know, I tried a lot of things, and pretty much he went with them. I'm sure there are a few things that he just passed on, but anything like that, you know. I had a keyboard player, this guy Richard Scheer, who worked on it, and I had a few of my guys playing on it. But I know Richard was doing that stuff, and yeah, I mean, if it worked, you know, literally, some things worked and some things didn't.
Mm.
And some things that worked are not on the record, and some things that didn't work are on the record.
So well, we were saying, sort of, yeah. Yeah, it's just how it is. I mean, we were saying, yeah. I mean, on the previous record, on Infidels, Dylan had just made Infidels and left off this song Foot of Pride, which is one of his best songs. This song Blind Willie McTell, which some people think is his single best song.
Yeah.
And then the original version of Tight Connection to My Heart, which was called
Somebody's Got a Hold of My Heart.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
And
I love Tight Connection. You know, Tight Connection's a great song, and we, you know, we worked on that a lot on vocals and changing lyrics, obviously. Yeah.
So I don't think you weren't aware at the time, I think, that he was taking a ton of lyrics for that song from what, Humphrey Bogart movies?
Yes.
Yeah. When did you become aware of that?
I never did. Just now.
Oh, like, yeah.
Now?
Yeah. Did you ever work on that, the previous recording of it, the one that's on the bootleg series? Did you ever try to mess with that one?
God, you know, I have to say that I'd have to listen to it, but I don't know.
Okay.
I know we worked on a few, but I'm trying to remember if Tight Connection, we did the drums again, maybe, possibly. I'd have to look at the record, but we did. Sly and Robbie played on a few other tracks, that might be one of them, but I'm not, you know, without looking at the record, I'm sorry, I don't have the record.
So was he scribbling away at lyrics like in the studio as you did vocals?
Yeah.
How did that work?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Scribbling away, and he would just go in and try them, and then if he'd listen back, and if he didn't like it, he'd scribble some more, you know, on a few of the songs. But Tight Connection and Somebody's Burning, Something's Burning, Baby.
Yeah. And on Seeing the Real You at Last also.
Yeah, Seeing the Real You at Last. Those three were the ones where he really, Emotionally Yours and I'll Remember You were pretty, I remember, those were pretty much he didn't mess with rewriting lyrics on those, as I remember. But, I mean, those other three, for sure, he did. We worked on those a lot.
So it becomes all the more a mystery because Tight Connection to My Heart, somewhere between the version that's on the bootleg series and the version that's on the album, he filled it with lines from like Humphrey Bogart movies, and even according to Clinton Halen, there is one line in that song that is from a Star Trek episode. So the mystery becomes more intense because how on earth, if he was scribbling them in front of you in the lyrics in the studio, how on earth was he pulling these lines from movies and TV shows? It's bizarre. Unless you remember Star Trek playing in the studio, which could actually solve this for us.
There was a TV in the studio. I can't say what was on it. But,
like a Bogart film marathon.
If you remember.
I have no idea, man. But you know, he could have. I mean, literally, some of the things. I'm not saying everything he redid. A lot of it, he did scribble for sure. He sat and wrote things, and then he sang them. So, you know, that doesn't mean that a lot of the other ones he didn't get from movies and TV. I don't know. I mean, you couldn't really tell with him, but literally, he was writing lyrics.
Right.
Something's burning, tight connection for sure. But, you know, like it is 32 years ago, guys.
Yeah, of course. I totally got it. What was sort of the state of his sobriety or lack thereof? Was he like drinking that you could tell? Let me put it
this way. One time I picked up a cup which I thought was my tea and it was his. And there was a lot of rum in that tea. he was drinking rum. But, you know, not with the bottle. And I did Mount Gay rum. That's what he was drinking. Yeah.
How much he later?
Mount Gay and soul food. But he didn't eat them. He didn't eat a lot, though. That's the other thing. He didn't really eat a lot. It was sort of he probably ate before. He didn't want to be seen eating, I would guess. You know, it's sort of that thing. You don't really want to when you Bob Dylan, you probably don't want people to see that you. You don't want people to see you eating, maybe. I don't know.
Did you have any sort of personal conversations with him, just like man to man, just talking about stuff besides the movie Mask?
Yeah, you know, I mean, we did about music and later on after the record, I met up with him once in L.A. and he had been to Brazil, and he was talking about the tuning, guitar tunings and stuff, and he was like really into it. And you know, he loved like Dion and the Belmonts. He used to talk about them a lot. You know, sort of like doo-wop. He was really into doo-wop. You know, that kind of thing. We would just literally not a lot, because you know we'd get in and we'd work, and then he didn't stay out late, you know? I mean, I have friends who played in his band, like, and they, you know, obviously they spent a lot of downtime and are at least one of my friends, Greg Sutton, who is bass player in one of his bands. Mm. And so he has great stories, because he used to hang with them a lot on the road. But when you're making a record, unless you're going out to dinner afterwards, which he didn't really do dinner, so it really wasn't like a thing, you know? I mean, after the fact, you know, when he had the Biograph party, you know, we hung out there and had a couple of drinks, and you know, it was, you know, a few years after, we were still in touch. And then, you know, recently, for one interesting side note is Stu Kimball, who was in this group Face to Face that I had produced from Boston, and he played on When the Night Comes Falling. He played on a few tracks. And then, like 15 years later, through Peter Wolf, he got like to try out for Dylan's band, and he got the gig, and he's been in the band for 20 years.
He's still there,
Dylan. Yeah, well, Dylan claimed not to realize he had been on the record. The thing was, he wasn't the studio. You know, Bob was there when Stu played a few times. So who knows? It had been 15 years, but I'm just saying it's interesting. Stu has now been in that band for like 20
years. That is weird. And you almost worked on Dylan's next record, right? Didn't he approach you about that?
There's an insane story. Yeah, tell this insane story.
And the story is 100% true. Basically, I had my studio on 37th Street in Manhattan, and I was driving back from like the New Music Seminar, which used to be sort of this convention that a few guys put on, a music convention, which was a really great music convention. A lot of New York artists were discovered through it and stuff. But I was coming back, and there was a sign, you know, you couldn't take a right onto 37th from 7th Avenue unless you had commercial plates. Well, I didn't have commercial plates, but I had a studio there, and I had a bunch of boxes of records and stuff that I had to bring in. So I took the right. This meter maid, you know, stopped me and got in front of the car and wanted me to back out into 7th Avenue, which I wasn't going to do. So basically, I just said, well, listen, I'll pull over. You call the cops, whatever. So I'm waiting there on the hood of my car, and I had some substances that I shouldn't have. The police were going to show up. So I gave them to Stu, actually. Stu was with me. And so he took the substances and went to the studio, to my studio, which was 3 doors down. And the cops get there, and they, like, literally throw me against the wall and slap handcuffs on me. The meter maid had said that I had tried to run her over in the car. So luckily, this guy in the crowd, seeing it all go down, he gave me a business card, and his father was a federal judge in Brooklyn, like a high-powered, like state Supreme Court or something. He said, listen, I saw it. I'm going to talk to my dad about it, because literally this is, you know, total bullshit. So I end up in jail for like overnight, and I get out, and literally, you know, I get a lawyer, and I say to my the woman has now claimed that I hit her with my car. So basically, that's a felony, you know, like, you know, I mean, you could go to jail for that. Like, so basically, she's taken work off. She's gone on, like, you know, disability. So I tell my lawyer, I say, follow that young lady. Let's find out what she's doing. And we actually got a PI, and we found out that she was, like, smoking crack and stuff. So literally, we got pictures and all that. We went to court.
But Bob, but you missed a meeting with Bob, right, because of this?
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah. The best part of the story is, so basically, Stu, my guitarist, goes to the gig with those substances that I gave him. And literally, he goes back to see Bob to tell Bob that I've been arrested. And Bob goes, yeah. Couldn't he come up with a better story than that if he didn't want to work on my record? So literally, I didn't get the gig. And when I sued the city, I said I lost this gig. So basically, the gig, I ended up getting, like, compensated for the gig and any royalties and stuff. So literally, I got paid for doing it without doing it.
So the city of
New York,
yeah. They paid you for a Bob Dylan album that you didn't get because of them.
Great moments in music business history.
And it's a real shame because his next album really sucked. And if he had you on it, I think Knocked Out Loaded.
Well, here's the thing, though. Here's the thing. I wasn't really... I mean, he had sent me some things, and I can't even say that I would have done it, you know? But I was going to go talk to him. You know what I mean? He had sent me some songs, and I wasn't really into the song. So... literally, it probably saved me from saying no, and I still got paid. So that's not a bad thing.
Tell the Mark Knopfler story, because he had worked on some of the tracks over the various sessions.
Oh, yeah. So the Mark Knopfler story is fantastic. Mark comes into the studio and, first of all, insults my... Oh, hold on one second. Insults my soon-to-be ex-wife, who is still my friend, who was a big fan of Dire Straits. So basically, she comes in and she says to Mark Knopfler, oh, you know, I love making movies. It's my favorite record. He said, oh, wow, I feel bad for you. That's your favorite record. Like that. So literally, he wasn't on the top of my list anyway. But then he listens to one of the songs, and I'm sorry, I don't remember which one.
Yeah.
But he goes, oh, you know what? That song needs a guitar. That I have a part in my mind, but I need chords. I need some pads in there. So he got his keyboard player from Dire Straits, who, you know, was there, and basically, so he was trying to tune the synthesizer to the track, because the track was, you know, these are tracks that had been worked on in 5 studios, and, you know, basically it wasn't like no one had a tuning pitch, you know, it wasn't happening. So he's tuning it up literally 2 hours, seriously. And he plays a part that, you know, a two finger just sustained 2 notes, like, through the song, which, you know, me and Bob look at each other, and we're wasting time. You know, Bob doesn't like the studio that much, so we're wasting his time. And then Knopfler comes in and listens to it a couple of times through, and he goes, you know what? It doesn't really need a guitar part, and then walks out. And literally, Bob's like, Bob, no, and Bob's like, literally, that's what working with him was like. That was why I wouldn't work with him again, you know? I forget the exact words, but it was that direction. So basically, we spent like 4 hours on literally nothing, except I got a good story out of it, so that's probably cool.
I wanted to return to the sound of the record, because that's something that you, in there's parts that you know, you've said many times that you might not do. And I mean, there are quote unquote 80s things. There's the synth parts, yeah. some of which are very cool, some of which maybe don't sound are now dated. Yeah, there's
like the
80s itself. Okay. There's snare sounds that, even when it's not the electro drums, there's like that big sort of stadium
big reverb sound.
So how much
for
of that
ballads, I mean, if that No, that was me. I'll have to take blame for that, because literally, no, but I'm honest, you know, literally at that time, big ballads, you know, had that kind of big snare sound. And, you know, we were, to go back to something you said earlier, we were, you know, trying to make a record that would get played on radio, and we were trying to have a bigger produced sound, and it was the 80s, so that's the sound that we were going for. So it was sort of, you know, which is what made me really happy about Dark Eyes, because literally I would have just been as happy to do that, but they didn't hire me to do that. They hired me to make it sound, you know, like pop for the 80s. Literally, you know, the Phil Collins sound, all that sound was, you know, the big snares and all that. That's what was happening on radio then. If you go back, Foreigner, that kind of thing, you know, it was like that kind of stadium sound. But, you know, I mean, some of them weren't like that. I would say the ballads were the things that sort of we did that with, and maybe and When the Night Comes Falling. And, you know, I mean, you wanted to have some sort of continuity to the record, which is difficult when it's recorded all over the world for many years. But, you know, literally, you know, the 80s were like that. And similarly, I had done a Hall & Oates record in the same sort of capacity, which was sort of trying to make it sound 80s, and I did Big Bam Boom, and you know, I try to convince Daryl and John for the last song to just sit at the piano and do a song, just the two of them at the piano, and they didn't do it. Literally, they didn't do it, and Bob did, and look, we got Dark Eyes, and we probably could have a great Hall & Oates song that people would still be talking about if they had done it, because literally, that's you get the magic out of that, and it doesn't get overly produced, and you just go, let's do it like old school, you know, which is still, I still love that kind of thing. I recently did an album with Paul Young, which was all Stax songs, and we did one cover that wasn't a Stax, and we did Words by you know, the Bee Gees, and we did it like pretty much one take, and those things really sound great. And obviously, Bob's doing that kind of thing now with covers, I guess. So, you know.
Yeah.
But, I mean,
He didn't really care. Because he's since become very, very particular about sounds in a way that he didn't used to be. You know, he's producing his own records and trying to create this old-timey. But it sounds like he was totally cool pretty much with letting you do your thing. He didn't really care that much. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's very rare for Bob, because for most of his career, he did not want producers to take a strong hand on his songs.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we did get on. I think he liked me. I think we got on pretty well. So, but, you know, then again, he didn't really want to, like, spend the time anyway. You know, I mean, he would be in... No, but it's true. He doesn't, you know, it's like he didn't... You know, he really wasn't a studio head. He didn't really want to do it, and it wasn't like going in with a band, which he does now, I guess. And that's more, you know, you're in with your band. His band's playing with him like 200 nights a year, so you know you can pretty much. It's more like a rehearsal, and I think he are more like playing live. It's more like the old school for him, like when he did all, you know, Blonde on Blonde, and they would go in for like 3 days and cut like 15 tracks, you know. And that's what he likes. So, you know, working with a producer and listening over and over and over to something. I doubt he even does that now. I would think he's going for straight takes. I would guess. I mean, I could find out and ask Stu, because I think Stu's playing on some of those records. So
yeah, I think you're right. I think even if the vocal cracks, he still uses the take. But
I think he's going for full takes like the old days, literally.
We have
just that. Instead of having to bother with writing new songs, he just does covers, which, you know, I guess he doesn't need any more songs. I'm sure his publishing takes care of him very well, you know. So he doesn't really have to write it. He never has to write another song. And that's why I'm really happy with the Dark Eyes thing. And look, that's 32 years ago, man.
Yeah.
That's like insane.
You know, in the last couple of minutes, when you got onto this record, you had just done all these really cool remixes from Born in the USA, from the Springsteen album. I'm a big fan of a more obscure one, Cover Me, which actually sounds like...
Yeah, I love Cover Me. That's like totally totally obscure. And that's actually a cool story, because literally Cover Me was written for Donna Summer.
I
didn't even know that. That was written for Donna Summer. So, like, when I got the tape... basically, there's this female, you know, black female voice on it, and I'm like, damn, because it didn't say the name. And then I realized it was Jocelyn Brown, who was a friend of mine, and I called her up. I said, Jocelyn, did you do a track with Bruce Springsteen? She said, oh yeah, 4 years ago, whatever. So literally, I sort of brought that out in the track, and
did
much more sort of reggae. And the reason they wanted me to remix that track was it was going to be a single, and he didn't like playing it live because he never was happy with the groove of it and the vibe of it, because he didn't write it for himself. He wrote it for Donna Summer, so it was pretty stiff. So they wanted me to sort of funk it up or groove it up. So I did I used this bass player named Brian Rock, who was in this group Mojo Naya, which was someone who was signed to Streetwise, my label at the time. And, you know, we did sort of a reggae thing on it, and then the delays and stuff. So then when they... on his vocals. So then when they played it live, like I went to Giant Stadium, and it was the first time they played it live, and they used sort of like the delays and the intro that I did as the intro on when he played it live. So that was sort of cool.
Yeah, no, I love that. And in general, what did you learn? You also did a Dancing in the Dark remix. When he plays that live, there's still people in the audience who sing the whoa-ohs that I think you overdubbed into that song.
Oh, I did. Yeah, there's all the background vocals on that. I mean, if you know the original, then you listen to the version I did, you know, the bells. And then, yeah, sort of a Phil Spector thing, which, you know, when we did the Phil Spector thing, it was like, obviously, he was a big fan of Phil Spector, so he was like really into it. And he came to the studio, and that was Power Station also, and he and the AC went down. It was like in the middle of the summer, and basically he went out and got us a case of beer and hung out with us, and basically, you know, after that he was like, oh yeah, I'm totally fine with what Arthur's doing. So I did Cover Me, and then Born in the USA. So, and Born in the USA, I used his engineer Toby Scott to engineer the mix, which, you know, he was sort of happy with also. But
and you did some radical stuff on Born in the USA. There was like a Freedom mix that's really wild.
Yeah. I just went for it, man, because by that time it was like, you know, the album had sold like 15 million copies. I wasn't going to mess anything up. I just went for it. And you know, I love all three of those mixes. I'm really happy with. I'm not, you know, sometimes I, you know, look back and I go, oh, you know, I just went for it. And it definitely had the energy, and he liked them all. So that, you know, when the artist and his Springsteen are okay with what you've done with their music, it's sort of cool, you know.
So we have like 1 minute.
Then through that and through Dylan, I got to meet Steve Van Zandt, who actually Jimmy Iovine strangely introduced us, and then we did the Sun City record after that, which both Dylan and Springsteen are on.
Yeah, so
and
Africa Bambaataa, your man was also on that, right?
Yeah, Miles Davis.
Yeah.
And, you know, Bono. Now, that's a... You should do... Listen, go back and listen to Sun City album, because it's an album.
Yeah,
you should do one of these on that, because literally...
It's a date. We will. That's a great idea, actually.
Yeah, that's awesome.
We could do a whole hour on this song, probably.
Yeah, well, the song... But then we did all these, like, you know, Bono...
Right.
Bono did, he wrote Silver and Gold for the project, and he went in with Keith Richards and Ronnie Wood to write track, and Keith was playing like slide guitar with his switchblade. I mean, and then Robert Palmer, their critic, played clarinet on that. You know, the New York Times music critic. So that's that would be great, and I'm sure Van Zant would love to talk about that too, you know, because literally that record, you know, we have this Miles Davis track that we made out of Miles' trumpet part, and then Herbie Hancock and Tony Williams and Ron Carter and Wayne Shorter went back into the studio and did a track under his trumpet track, which it's an amazing, amazing track, actually.
Awesome.
It's sort of like this mystery Miles Davis track that no one really knows.
Well, it's a date we will do that. And we've been talking to Arthur Baker about the 1985 album Empire of Burlesque and much more. And this has been Rolling Stone Music Now. Thanks so much for being here, Arthur. And we will be back next Friday at 1 p.m. on Volume. And in the meantime, download us as a podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And have a great week. We'll see you next week.